My name's Damien Edwards. I'm a program manager on the web platform and tooling team here at Microsoft. We make products like ASP.NET, the IIS web server and streaming media services. We also do Visual Studio web tooling, which is the sub-team that I'm actually on. And some of the other things we do in there include tooling for the JavaScript editor in Visual Studio, the ASPX and MVC project systems, and any of the other sort of tooling associated with those things that you might be using. Today I'm going to have a talk to you about jQuery. I'd like to cover a few things. I want to get an idea of how many people currently are using jQuery and what they do. Put your hands up. Okay, quite a few of you. So there's quite a few web developers in the room, which is really, really good. I want to ask you a personal question now. How many of you actually enjoy writing JavaScript? A lot fewer hands go up that time, so I've got about two or three. What's that?
JavaScript
in general. So the question I ask people after they generally answer, I hate writing JavaScript. I say, well, why? What is it about JavaScript that you don't like doing in particular? And I generally get a lot of different answers. Now, I'm happy for people to yell them out at me now, but the general ones I hear are that I don't like the fact it's not typed. It's a scripting language. It's not a real language. The tooling is terrible. It's unreliable. It's error-prone. And the general themes like this that continue when people talk about JavaScript. Well, hopefully, after today, I'll change your opinion a little bit of JavaScript. Itself, just the core language, but also when used in conjunction with jQuery, which, you know, if you're working in web browsers, certainly makes a lot of our lives a lot simpler when dealing with a lot of the challenges that working with the DOM and AJAX can present. So to start out, I'm going to do a little bit of a JavaScript refresher, because I'm a firm believer that if you want to be a really good jQuery developer, you should be a really good JavaScript developer. And there is a lot of power in the JavaScript language, and I'm a big, big fan of the language. The more I use it, the more I really enjoy using it. So we're going to do a little bit of a refresher first. I want to ask you, who here thinks that JavaScript is an object-oriented language? Just raise your hand if you think that's the case. There are not many people putting their hands up. Okay, so I'm going to tell you that JavaScript is an object-oriented language. In fact, we'll see that JavaScript is very much about objects, including concepts like inheritance. Now, it may not seem like the object-oriented languages you're used to using, particularly on the .NET stack, where we have the definition of a static definition of what an object is going to be. You know, we call it a class. We don't have that construct in JavaScript. We just have objects, and they can inherit from other objects through something called their prototype. But it is most definitely an object-oriented language. Second question, is JavaScript a functional language? And by functional, I don't mean are you able to do things with it. I mean is it is of the ilk of functional languages like Scheme and Erlang and those type of things. So yes, JavaScript is a functional language. If JavaScript is about objects, it is also about functions. And there's these two things, when used together, that really give JavaScript its power. And we'll have a little bit of a look at that right now. So let's start out with objects. I mentioned that in JavaScript, it is object-oriented. We can do quite a lot of things with objects. There are a number of ways we can create objects. Thank you. We can use the object constructor by calling new. That's a familiar-looking keyword. It is one that throws a few people off, because when they see new in JavaScript, they think of what new looks like in a language like C# or Java, and they instantly associate that with how it should behave. Try and get that out of your head. The way that new works in JavaScript isn't quite the same as the way it works in other languages. But this is one way we can create an object, but you'll generally find that you won't do this. JavaScript has a great feature called object literals, which allows us to create objects on the fly, anonymously, because objects don't have a type, essentially, in JavaScript, by using this curly bracket notation. So I'm just saying my var O is equal to a new empty object literal. So the type of O will be object, and then I can start decorating this or populating this with whatever members it is that I want. So I can say foo is equal to some string. I can say bar is equal to some function. Now, I haven't looked at functions yet, but this is an anonymous function, otherwise known as a lambda. Anyone use lambdas in C#? Yep, okay. If you use length, then you'll be very familiar with the concept of a lambda. Or any of the other primitive types that I want to do, so I could make something that's a number. Or I can nest my objects, so I could have something like this. So now I have a B member on my O object, which is also an object, and I could start doing the exact same thing here and building that graph out if I wanted to. And then we have arrays as well, so I could create a Z member, which I could either initialize by calling the array constructor, or what you'll generally see people do is they use the array literal, which is just square bracket, and again, because nothing is typed, I can just fill this with whatever it is that I want. In this case, undo that formatting, a string, and then a number, and then another empty object. So objects are cool. So I mentioned that objects, we also have the concept of inheritance. It may not be obvious here how that works, and the truth is it's not obvious here. In fact, if you're using object literals, you're limited in the popular versions of JavaScript, the ones that everyone currently implements, in how you can use prototypes. In fact, you really can't. If you want to use inheritance using this magical thing called a prototype, you have to go back to using the new keyword. So let me define an object that I then want to inherit from something else. So I'm going to say, we're going to see this function thing come in here, which seems a bit strange when I'm dealing with objects, but this is the way it works. Let's define an animal. So now, while it looks like a function, the animal function is actually an object, just like anything else. Everything is an object in JavaScript. And then what I can say is, let's look at animal, and I have a member on here called prototype. And I can set this equal to an object. So I have animal, which is a function, and then I have animal.prototype, which is an object. And on here I can put a member, we'll just say string, and in here, in the function, which we'll call a constructor for want of a better term, but we do term these constructors in JavaScript, I can do anything that I would like to do to initialize this object when it's created, or I can add members to this object that are specific to the instance that will be created when this is invoked. And I can do that by using this keyword. You can see that my IntelliSense is giving me the existence of an A member, because we know that the prototype of animal, which I've declared underneath it, has that member. But I'm going to add a totally new member to this every time it's initialized, which can be a function. Okay, something like that. So then to use this, at the moment you can think of this as your declaration. I can go ahead and create myself an instance of this by using the new operator. And now animal is an instance of my lowercase animal is an instance of the animal function. Now, what actually happens when you call a JavaScript constructor like this is a little strange. What you get is the a new object, which is the result of running that constructor and then setting the new object's prototype property to the prototype property of the animal function. Okay? I'm not going to dive into that a little bit more, but it's a quirk that you have to be aware of when you start doing prototypical inheritance in JavaScript. But to prove the point, if I now do animal dot, what we'll see in here is that my IntelliSense is indeed giving me members for A, which was defined the animal's prototype, and a member Z, which is the function that I declared inside the constructor of that object type. So JavaScript has objects, and we can see JavaScript has functions, because I've been using functions to create objects. So let's look a little bit more at functions. Scroll down, give myself some room. So I can use, there are a number of different ways you can create functions. There are different terminologies for the different types of functions in JavaScript. Essentially, they're all kind of the same. They just have slight differences in how they're parsed, where they're legal, and how they can be called. So we saw an example above where I created a function and I called it a constructor. Now, the only thing that made it a constructor was the fact that I called it with the new keyword. You don't declare it as a constructor. We use a convention, which is putting a capital on the beginning of a function in JavaScript to denote it as a constructor, just because it makes it easier for me as the developer to understand that I meant for this to be called with the new keyword. It's one of the not-so-good parts of JavaScript that we have to do things like this. The reason we have to do that is because if you don't call that function with the new keyword, bad things can happen. And when I say bad things can happen, what I mean is that where I've referenced this inside of that animal constructor, no longer does this represent the new object that you're constructing, but this represents the global scope. And so everything that you thought you were assigning to the new object is now getting assigned to the global scope. So you may be overriding members that other people have set up, or you may be creating arbitrary members on your global scope, which in the browser, of course, is the window object. So we use the capital to make sure that we don't do that. But I can just have a normal function like this. In this case, this is just a bog standard function. I haven't called it anywhere yet, so it doesn't do anything special. If I refer to this inside here, this is going to refer to the global scope. This is what most people think about when they think about functions in JavaScript. So this is called a function declaration. I can also do a function expression and assign it to a variable. So rather than having function foo and declaring it like that, I can have function bar, which is actually a variable which I have assigned a function expression to. A function expression is just a different name for a lambda, essentially. Now, the only difference between these two in reality is the JavaScript standard dictates some rules about when you can use one over the other. Now, what we have to keep in mind is, like all standards, they're not always implemented according to the letter. And so when we start talking about these sort of things, you can get different behavior in various browsers based on how they've implemented those things. So it's easier just to think of these two things superficially as pretty much the same thing. Just a slightly different syntax. But now that I have my bar variable, I can call that like a function, because it is just a function. Okay, it's just a lambda. The other thing that's interesting to note is that scope in JavaScript is at the function level. We don't have block scope, like you would expect like in something like C#. So anything you declare within the body of a function will be visible anywhere within that function. Doesn't matter if you're inside a for loop or inside any other type of block construct. What we can do, though, however, is nest functions. So I am inside the function body of foo at the moment, and it's perfectly legal for me to declare a function bar inside here. It helps if I get the braces right. But just to avoid confusion, let's call it something else, because I have a bar function underneath. And this is totally normal. So this function test is now in the scope of in the scope of foo. So it is only visible, obviously, to anything within the same scope as foo. It's also visible to itself. You can have recursive functions, that's fine. You can call yourself over and over if you want to get yourself into a loop like that. But we're going to see a little bit later why this function scope thing is very, very important to remember. So if we have lambdas in JavaScript, function expressions, functions as first-class citizens, functions I can pass as parameters to other functions, functions that can be returned from functions, functions that can be properties on objects, everything that you enjoy in a functional language, then we must have closures. Now, closures is something I hate trying to explain because it's just a difficult concept to explain without just writing some code. So I have an existing function here that is probably the simplest way I can show the minimal reproduction of a closure. I have a function foo, and just to avoid ambiguity, I'm going to remove that one. By the way, it's totally valid to have two functions declared with the same identifier in JavaScript, just the last one wins. Okay? It just overrides the existing one, because when you say function foo, all you're really saying is, hey, add a foo member to the global scope and assign this function to it. So if you do that again, it'll just go, oh, there's already a foo member there, I'm going to assign the new function to it. So you can get yourself into a pickle, but it is valid. So inside function foo, I'm declaring a local variable called I, and then I'm declaring an inner function called bar, using a function expression, from which I return I. And then I'm returning bar. So what I have here is a function that, when executed, returns a function. So if I type foo, that's going to return me another function, so I can immediately invoke that again using another set of parentheses. Now, the strange thing about this, though, is that let's think about how this executes. I execute foo, I declare I, which is in the scope of foo, so as long as foo is around, I is going to be around. I then declare my bar, which returns I, which this function can do because it's in the same scope as foo, so we can see I, and then I'm returning from foo bar. So now foo is gone. Whatever stack was built up for foo has disappeared. I've returned from that function, and what I've returned is the inner function bar. So does anyone see the issue here? So I theoretically should no longer exist because the scope of I is foo, and foo has finished execution. The reason this works is because of closure. So what happens is the terminology is used is that this function, the bar function, is closing over the I variable even though it's not in charge of that variable scope. So after foo is finished executing, I is going to continue living on until such time that the closure falls out of scope. And then, of course, everything just goes away. Again, this is very, very, very important, especially in a browser programming language, because we do everything asynchronously. Everything is driven in this event loop model. So you generally set things up, and then you wait for an event to happen. There'll be some function that you attach to a handler, and then you might do something in the body of that function. You declare it, it's sitting there waiting for someone to click on something, and you need that function to execute in the scope that it was originally declared in. So closures are very, very important. And they also offer a lot of power. But they can take a while to get your head around if you haven't used them a bit. And they can lead to interesting bugs as well. Another thing I want to touch on before we jump into more jQuery is the this keyword. Now again, this is something that's difficult to talk about because we like to use the word this in English when we're talking about things like this. But in this case, I'm actually talking about this. So this is a keyword in JavaScript. So I can say this dot, and this will give me something. It's not guaranteed what it is. The only time it's guaranteed is when you're in the root of the global scope, like I am here, because I'm not inside any other functions. I'm just hard on the margin of this file. You're going to get global scope. This will reference global scope, which in the browser case, as I said before, is the window object. If I'm inside a function that is in global scope, so if I say this is in global, and I've done the same thing again, and I refer to this inside here, you're still inside global scope. I think I mentioned that before. If you have a function in global scope, by default, it will be in global scope. But it's not actually that dictates the scope of this. It's not that dictates this. It's this that dictates this. You can change the scope of this for a function when you call it. So every function, as I said before, is an object. So I've got this thing called this is in global. And if I look at this, the IntelliSense is telling me, oh, you've got things like alert, because we think it's the window object. But we don't actually know how this function is going to be called. I can jump down to this is in global. And because it's an object, it has its own members. And one of the root members on all functions inside JavaScript are these two, the apply method and the call method. And what these functions allow you to do is call the function and pass in something else that you want to act as the this keyword. Now, anyone who's used jQuery will instantly recognize this. Whenever you're doing event handling or things like that, or you're using the $.each function, you'll know that the this keyword mutates. It changes depending on what function you're calling. And this is how they do it. It's a core feature of JavaScript, and it's something that you have to keep in mind, in that this can change, and especially when using jQuery. jQuery takes advantage of this extensively. And it is quite powerful. It's a powerful construct, enabling to do these things. So function and call and apply are very, very similar. I'm not going to go into the differences between them. You can look that up if you want to learn a little bit more about JavaScript. But the meta point here to take away is that this keyword is not constant. You can't predict what it's going to be. You can only assume. If you're the caller of the function, then sure, you know what it's going to be. But you have to keep in mind that it can be mutated. So that's our JavaScript refresher. I'll take... Anyone have any questions about JavaScript before I jump into jQuery? Right, so we're all on board. Excellent. So let's jump back and look at jQuery. Everyone loves JavaScript now, I hope. So what is jQuery? jQuery is an open source JavaScript library created originally by a guy called John Resig, who works for the Mozilla Foundation. It's lightweight. It's designed primarily to help you work within the browser, particularly against the DOM, finding elements, manipulating elements, animating elements, applying arbitrary effects to elements, updating their CSS. and it also has some great helper functions for performing AJAX operations. It is also extremely extensible, not only due to the fact that jQuery is written in such a way to be extensible, but just due to the nature of JavaScript. JavaScript, because of its dynamic nature, because, as we saw before, I can create a property and just start create an object and just start adding properties to it, or I can override existing members just by declaring and assigning to them again, you can change the behavior of jQuery very simply. And that has led to a very rich plugin architecture. So we have this idea of what's known as jQuery Core, which is the jQuery library itself that everyone knows and loves. And then we have all these plugins that extend jQuery to make it do other wonderful things. Well, what does this mean to Microsoft developers? A couple of years ago now, who used Microsoft AJAX? Most people who do web development would have. So, I mean, the history of Microsoft and jQuery is that we did this AJAX library thing a few years ago now. And then after a couple of years, we noticed the industry trend was a lot of people were using jQuery. And the reality was that jQuery did a lot of things really well that we didn't do. And we were doing things in our AJAX library and our AJAX futures that jQuery didn't particularly do well. It didn't really cover. And so our strategy at that time was, well, let's do both. Let's adopt jQuery as a library. We'll ship it in Visual Studio. It'll appear in your new web projects when you create them. And we'll continue with the Microsoft AJAX library to help fill the gap between what jQuery does and what we want to do on the Microsoft platform. And then we came to a place where we realized, well, why do we even continue doing that? Why don't we just take all of our investments in AJAX technology from the web platform and tools point of view and just base them on jQuery? And so that's where we are today. In terms of our AJAX efforts, and when I say AJAX, I'm referring to JavaScript development in the browser, not particularly just asynchronous requests. jQuery is our foundation for doing that. So we still ship jQuery out of the box. You still get support for jQuery if you call product support services. We host jQuery on our AJAX CDN. We also host a number of plugins up there. And we are not only developing plugins of our own, we are also developing parts or plugins that are actually being adopted into jQuery Core. So the jQuery conference was on just this weekend gone in Boston. And John Resig announced at that conference what's happening to the plugins that Microsoft has developed thus far. You may have heard about the jQuery templating plugin that we've built, data linking, and globe and localization. Those efforts all came out of our original efforts in Microsoft AJAX. So we had an AJAX futures library. I think it was called the AJAX 4 preview or something at some point. And they included a lot of this work. We basically took the work we did, we approached the jQuery team, we worked with the jQuery team to make sure that what we were doing was jQuery-esque, and it's now at the point now where there are official jQuery plugins, and indeed some of those are being adopted into Core, like the jQuery templating plugin. So how do you get it? I said it's in the box. You can download it from jQuery.com. They released 1.4.3 this weekend, just gone. The one in the box in Visual Studio is 1.4.1. But, of course, you can just copy and paste the 1.4.3 files on top. And you go from there. Setting up your project beyond that, if you're using web forms, you can use the script manager to load jQuery. Who's using web forms predominantly over MVC? Okay, just a few hands going up. Everyone else using MVC? Yeah, a few people, okay. So if you're using the script manager and you like the concept of debug versus release scripts, which we supported in the AJAX library. You can do the same with jQuery. There's a minified version of jQuery. You can see here in the download section, they call it production and development. So the production version is the one that's had all the comments stripped down. It's been minified using the Google Closure library. So it's stripped down to its smallest possible size. And then there's the development version, which we would have called the debug version using the old AJAX terminology. So you can still do that. You can rename the files, have the script manager... load the appropriate one depending on whether your app's in release mode or debug mode, or you can just manage that yourself and keep the file names the same. So let's have a look at jQuery in a little bit more depth. As I mentioned, jQuery is really around doing a few things really, really, really well, and then being open so that other people can create plugins to build upon that foundation. The thing that really set jQuery apart when it first came out, was this idea of using CSS selectors as a query language for finding elements in the DOM. Anyone who's been doing JavaScript DOM development for a while, since before the days of jQuery, will know how hard and painful it was to work with the DOM with its raw API. If I had a set of elements across my page that were somehow connected via a class attribute or by the fact that they had a similar parent or something like that, and I wanted to collect those together into an array or a node list so I could iterate over them and do something, that was very, very difficult. You had to write your own methods that would walk the DOM tree in various directions if you wanted to, say, get me every third node and things like that. That's stuff you had to do from the ground level. Whereas jQuery recognized, well, we have this great syntax in CSS called CSS selectors, which let me build up a string that describes the conditions by which I want to match elements to pull them in. And that's what jQuery is built on. So if we look down here, this is our hello world of jQuery. I just have a plain HTML file. It has nothing in it except a very basic style block, which is setting some stuff in the body. It has an empty div tag. And then I have a pulling in the jQuery library in the bottom of my page. And then I have some inline script. I'm using this dollar function. So you can think of the dollar function as the jQuery constructor. Technically, it's not a constructor because we're not calling it with the new keyword. But if you actually look at the source code, calling the dollar function will actually call the jQuery constructor, the real one, for you. So we start out with this dollar function, which is just a alias for the jQuery global object. So dollar is just a nice shortcut that they also overtake. And then what I'm doing is I'm passing in a function to dollar. So I'm immediately using the fact that JavaScript is a functional language. I'm passing it in a lambda. What that means to the constructor of jQuery is that, oh, you've given me a function as the first parameter. What that means is you want me to run that function when the document is finished loading. So this is your document onload event handler. Okay? The other way you might see people do this is the long-winded way, where they go, ask jQuery to give them the document object, and then they call the ready method on that, and then they pass in a function. This is exactly the same thing. The way I'm doing it is just shorter. So I'm passing in a function, and then inside this function is where I'm actually doing my work. This is important because anyone know what happens if you try and manipulate the DOM from JavaScript before the page is finished loading? Yeah, bad things in general. In IE6, you'd get a crash. In various other browsers, you'll get nasty error messages. The general rule of thumb is that you must wait for the DOM load event to finish, saying, yes, the document structure, as I've loaded it from the server, is now finished. You are ready to start manipulating it. That's why this is a first-level construct in the jQuery constructor. So then I'm using the jQuery constructor again, and I'm saying I'm passing in a string. When we pass in a string as the first parameter to the jQuery constructor, it says, oh, a string, not a function. This is a CSS selector. I'm going to parse this string using a library called Sizzle, which is actually part of jQuery, but you can extract it out. And Sizzle is a library that looks at strings, turns them into CSS queries that it then runs over the DOM. In this case, mine is really, really simple. Anyone who's done CSS will know that if you just give it a word, that's an element type descriptor, so it's going to look for any elements that match the word, in this case, body. So now, at the end of calling this function, what I have is a jQuery collection, which is just an array, JavaScript array, augmented a bit with other things, that contains this single element. We know there's only one body element in my document, so I know it's only going to have one thing in it. Then I'm calling the append method. So now we're into jQuery-specific methods. The append method takes a string and appends it to the DOM of every element that you have in the current collection that you're operating on. So I'm appending the text, hello world. It's going to look at that and say, oh, I need to create a text node to do that. It'll do that for you and append it to the body object. And so if I open my browser and I run that, I hit F5, you know, what we end up with is hello world. There we go, when the browser finishes loading. So that is our hello world of jQuery. So let's dive a little bit more into selectors. In this case, what I have, I'll just zoom out so you can see the overall structure of this document. What I have here is, again, a standard document, but I've just got a bit more markup in here. So I'm going to demonstrate how we can use selectors to find specific things. At the top of the document, what I have is an unordered list that I'm using as a navigation menu. So I've given it an ID of nav, just contains some LIs with some anchor tags in it. It's pretty standard stuff. One of these has a span in it. Okay, I think interesting to note. The second one is another LI that I'm just using as a standard list.
I have some nested elements inside here. Some of them have their class attributes set. I have two that have the same class attribute set here. And then I just have a couple of paragraph tags underneath that with some filler text. And I have an anchor tag which has a rel attribute set on it. Underneath that, I'm just going to go straight into some jQuery, and we're going to look at the different types of selectors. So I showed you the first one. Note that I'm still inside my dollar function, so none of this is going to run until the body, the document load event, has finished running. So let's have a look. I'm going to find all the li elements in this document just by passing in this. And what I want to do is I want to add to the CSS class attribute on there a CSS class I've created called Highlight. If we look at the top of this document, you'll just see I've declared a class in my CSS called Highlight. So now if I go back and I look at this one, this is my document here, and I refresh that, you'll see that my Highlight is just making things yellow, that script is run, it's found all the li tags, and it's changed their class to Highlight, and hence they get the background color. Pretty trivial stuff. So let's try something different. Let's find something based on its class. So this time, rather than passing in li, I'm going to pass in a CSS selector that targets class. Now, we saw I have some elements with a class of foo. So I'm going to pass in .foo, which is a standard CSS selector syntax. Hit F5 this time, and this time you'll see that it's found the two elements that had the class of foo. One of them was the span, and the other one was the li. Doesn't matter what they are, as long as they have the class, it's going to get it applied. Next, I'm going to do it based on ID. CSS notation for an ID is using a hash. So hash foo, if we look up the top here, or hash nav this time. I'm going to target this element at the top, so I'm going to change this to nav. Hit F5, now I'm targeting the top one. So these are all pretty simple things I'm doing so far. Let's look at something that's a little more modern. IE7 and above introduced support for the attribute selector, and every other browser on the planet already supports it. So what I'm going to do this time is I'm going to say, well, find any anchor element that has its rel attribute set. So A for the type, open square bracket, puts me into attribute selector mode, and I'm just saying, if rel is set, if it exists, then select it. Hit F5, and we'll see now that this single anchor tag that I set down here with the rel attribute selected is our set has been selected. Now you can do really funky things here. The CSS syntax also supports matching exact values, so I can put the whole URL in. You can use various prefixes to say, well, if it starts with this or it ends with this, or if it's comma separated, if one of the values is this, or if it's hyphen separated, one of the values is this. There's a whole lot of different operators you can put in here before the equal sign that will change what part of the attribute the string will actually match. And those are all standard CSS3 selectors. They're part of the CSS3 selectors module. So that's where you would look those up if you want to look at those. Other things we can use are filters. So once I've got my list of LIs, I can start filtering down that collection before I actually operate on it. So rather than immediately calling add class, what I'm going to do is say, well, actually what I want you to do, what I'm going to do is in here, sorry, using the pseudo class CSS construct, which is a colon followed by the keyword, and I'm going to select every even one. Okay, so because the indexes are zero based, I'm getting zero and then two, etc., etc. And similarly, I have it for odd as well. If I can spell, and of course that's going to select the alternate one, so that's fairly simple. We have first, we have last child, we have first child, we have some more complex ones that don't exist in CSS, like has. So what has will do is it just operates like a function. You can pass in another selector as the parameter to has, so then it'll match on the first selector, which is li, and then it'll say, well, okay, you found all the li's, but only give me the li's that also match this selector. In this case, has, so you could do that. And we also have a not as well, which is the inverse of has. So you can build very complex selectors up, which is kind of cool. Then the last thing we can do is you can combine these things together. So in this case, I'm going to find all the ULs, and then I'm going to call the find method on the jQuery collection, which will say, okay, all the ULs that I found, look at all the children and find any span tags, because I'm passing in another selector to the find method. And then for those elements that you filtered down to, add the highlight class. Calling the end function undoes the previous destructive operation. So when I called the constructor, I did $UL, I got a collection of ULs. I then said, find me any spans that are children of any of those ULs. That's a destructive function. Because I had this many, I had ULs, and then I said, find the children, and so I made the collection smaller. So I did some stuff on that collection, and then calling end reverts the state back to the line before the find span. So jQuery will actually remember the state of the collection as you're traversing through it and filtering it and modifying it, which is really cool. It lets you do this nice chaining that we're seeing here. You might note that there's no semicolons at the end of these lines. This is a single statement. And the reason that works is because most of the functions on the jQuery object actually return itself again. It returns the jQuery object again, the one that you're working with. So that lets you build up these nice chains of functionality in which you generally just indent and use new lines to structure nicely. So then once I've done that, I'm now working with this collection again. I'm going to call the CSS method of jQuery, and I'm passing it in. You can see the first... I've got a curly bracket here, and I've got a curly bracket down here. That denotes an object literal. That's what we looked at previously in our JavaScript refresher. And then I'm just passing it in an anonymous object, a brand new object that has a color member and a background color member. And you'll go, oh, well, they match the CSS color properties, and that's exactly what's happening here. If you call the CSS method and you pass it an object, it'll reflect over that object, look at the members on that object, see if they match known CSS properties, and if they do, they'll apply those to the current style of the object, to the element that you're working on. So if I run it now, it's going to do a whole bunch of stuff like that, because I've asked it to do multiple things. If we look, I said, okay, find me the spans and highlight them. So yes, I can see that the spans that I had are now yellow. Then I said, okay, then go back and set the CSS for all ULs to red. Well, we can see that's happened. And the anchor tags don't pick that up because anchor tags don't inherit the color property. You have to set it explicitly. And then set the background to that hex color value, which is black. And you can see that's happened just as well. So this does throw a few people the first time they see it, this idea of chaining multiple things together rather than having statement, 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 statement. But I just want to show you how much you can use this. Because I'm a really big fan of it. So what I want to show you is I have a previous application that I have built, and I may actually have it open already. Aha. So this is the site.js file for another application I wrote. It's about 390 lines. But the interesting thing is this bit here. Now, I can tell you that that statement actually starts here. So this is the this. You can see here I'm going $this. This is a jQuery collection. And then I proceed to call a whole bunch of things on it for the next, 26 lines or something. And the reason this works, as I said, is because I start out with a collection. I start out with whatever this currently has in it. This is just a variable I've called $this. And then I'm saying, okay, find me any parents that have the tile class. And then I'm going to call this rotate3di function, which incidentally is the result of a plugin that I added to jQuery. Someone else wrote this and I'm using it because it does a nice 3D rotation effect. And then to that I'm passing in, you can see that I've got a ternary operator here in my first parameter. Second parameter is a number. And the third parameter is this big honking object literal here, from there to there. And then that object literal contains a couple of members. I've got sidechained, which is a function. And I've got complete, which is another function. And then within that function, I'm using $this again. And you can see here is a really good example of chaining. So I'm saying CSS on this collection, then find inner and set some CSS on that, and then call end to undo that find. So now I'm back to here. Toggle the class, find some images, set the attribute the title attribute equal to something. Then end that last one, which was this one. So now I'm back to here again. Now I want you to find any children that are p-tagged with the info class, set the text on them, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now the reason you would do this, why wouldn't you just end each statement and then start from here again? This is more performant. I mean, if you maintain the state of it as you go forward, yeah?
You just show the results?
Can I share the result? I don't think I've got it running at the moment. if you want to see this application, it's up on CodePlex. It's called Who is That? So I'll just bring that up because it is kind of cool if you do get it. Codeplex.com. It's a board game. Online board game multiplayer. And the effect is it flips the cards around. So the reason you would do this is because if you can maintain the state of that variable for a long time, if you're going to be working with either it or anything that is children of it in the DOM, then you don't have to recreate that variable. You don't have to create it, store it in a variable, keep referring to it. If you want to find children, find those, assign those to another variable, etc., etc., etc. You can do it much more in a much cleaner fashion just by doing a single statement that walks down the DOM, walks back up the DOM using the end structure and so on. Okay, so that's selectors. Let's look at events. One of the most painful things to deal with in JavaScript and the browser are events. Before jQuery was around, there were other libraries that abstracted out the event model in the browser. The biggest reason this was a problem was because IE used one model for doing events and everyone else used a different model. There's actually a good reason they did that. If you look at the history of browser development, you'll understand why. And with IE9, I'm glad to say that IE9 now supports the standards way of doing event subscription, so you can have the same code that runs everywhere. But everyone always uses a library to do events, because the DOM API for events is really just hideous, and it's much nicer to use something like jQuery. So if I open up this page, and we'll just talk through what this page is going to do. I have a few elements on this page, and I'm going to have a look at how I can use jQuery to help subscribe to various events on this page and then make fun things happen. If I click on the button, I'm just adding some text to the bottom of the page here. If I click on any of these links, I'm just adding another link to the list. And I've got a fun thing here, which is tick this checkbox, and then I have a little thing that comes up, which is tracking the mouse position. Positioning it next to the mouse, and you'll see the state of the numbers is keeping up to date with the current X and Y coordinates. Now, if you wanted to write this 10 years ago, it was totally possible, and you know, people like Google Maps after 2004 really led the way in doing this type of stuff, but it was difficult, and making it work in more than one browser was particularly difficult. With something like jQuery, this stuff becomes a lot easier. So I have some markup. So this is my markup on that page. I've got my button. I've got my input checkbox, which I checked to turn on mouse tracking or not. I have my links. And then I have this div that represents that box that was following the cursor around with the coordinates of the mouse in it. I've just got a definition list and a couple of definition terms to track that. And so then I have all the fun where I actually go ahead and do this. So let's look at the fundamentals of doing events in jQuery. So if I create a jQuery collection, let's just say I create a jQuery collection that contains all the divs in the page, and I'll zoom up a bit so we can see that. One of the core methods we get is the bind method. The first parameter to the bind method is the name of the event that you want to bind to. So in this case, I can say I want to bind to the click event. The second parameter, it says here in IntelliSense that it's object data, but you generally don't need to pass it data. So the second one can just be the function that you want to act as the handler for the event. So I can just pass it a lambda or a function expression. And so this is my setup of how I get a function to run when the click events happens on any div element. If I add a parameter to the function object, what you'll get populated as that parameter is the event object. Now, if you've worked with browser events, you're probably thinking in IE, you have this global event object that you have to check, and in every other browser, the event object is always passed into the function. Again, this is a wrapper, and this is the model that you use if you use jQuery. The event object is always passed in. And it's not the browser event object, it's a wrapped event object. So I can say, if I want to augment my IntelliSense a bit and just tell Visual Studio what this event is, this object is, I can say, well, for the param name M, can you assume, please, that is a jQuery event, and I'll spell it right, a jQuery event object. And then what we'll see is when I do E dot, I get a few more members on there. Because the IntelliSense knows how to look at that member and look at those things. So the event object that jQuery gives you has the standard members like how to cancel bubbling, which the standard way is stop propagation. So that's going to stop that click event from bubbling up to the parent. If I've clicked on something like an anchor tag, which has a default action when you click on it, so when you click on an anchor tag, it navigates, you want to stop that. We have something else called prevent default. You'll also generally return false as general best behavior if you want that to happen. And then if you're working with things like mouse events or keyboard events and you want to get what mouse was clicked, what was the position of the mouse button, what was the position of the cursor, what key was hit on the keyboard, there's things like e.keycode or char code, e.which, which abstracts both of those down to a single number that represents either the ASCII code or the control key code. E.pageX and e.pageY, which is the coordinates of the mouse at the time that the event was fired, and so on and so forth. And these are all documented on the jQuery documentation site. So I can use the bind method to bind to any event. Not just DOM events, you can make up your own events if you like. They don't have to be on DOM elements. You can use them on arbitrary JavaScript objects if you like. But generally you're going to be using it with DOM events. We also have a number of shortcut members that make this a bit easier. So rather than using this long-winded way, I could just say dot click and then just pass the function to that. So jQuery identifies or recognizes what the most common event handlers that are set up are, and we have first-class functions to let you do that. Now, conversely to bind, we also have unbind, which doesn't take a function. It just takes a name, and this destroys it. So if you have that bound to click, calling unbind on click, we'll just unbind any function that's currently listening for the click event. You can also trigger them. So if you've set up a whole bunch of events, and perhaps you're using custom events, so they're never going to get fired by the user because you're not listening to click, you've just created Damien's great event and you're waiting for it to get fired, you can trigger that, you know, by doing something like this. And you'll just trigger the demo event on everything in that collection, and if there are any event handlers that you've set up with the bind method that are also attached to the demo event, they will fire. So you can do custom eventing with jQuery as well, which is kind of cool. Okay, so that's the basics of eventing. You can look through the jQuery library to see what other helper methods are. There's a hover method for doing hover in and out and things like that. Yes?
How can you pass parameters down to the event? And I don't want the closer one because I want a loop.
Sure. So there's no reason that you can't declare your handler out here like this. Yep, and I can type. And then you just pass that in. That's totally fine, okay? So you can do that if you want to reuse it, for instance. The other question was, how do you pass in data parameters?
Yeah, I want to pass in data, not a reference to variable, right?
Yep, so that's what the second parameter is for if you want to use it. You can pass in data in here, and then that'll get passed along as the second parameter along here, like so. Okay? You can also do things called namespaced events. It's a little bit more advanced, but if you're using custom events, so if I have like a demo event, or even a click event, I can prefix that with demo dot. And what that means is it looks at the second part and says, okay, the click event is what you're actually attaching into. And it looks at the first part and says, but you want this to be namespaced. And what it lets you do is that then, if you're creating a plugin, for instance, you can then go ahead and easily unbind all the... So that's going to unbind all the events that were created in the demo namespace. But if other plugins had subscribed to the click event on anything else that was created, you're not going to accidentally unbind those. Okay? This was introduced a few versions ago and is a very, very powerful feature. If you're using custom eventing, so even if you're not using the DOM, but you like using jQuery for custom eventing between plain objects or prototypical objects, this is also a really, really powerful feature. So let's have a look at how we actually go about how we would use this. So I looked at my page before, is using the click helper function to attach to the click event of this button. So if I push F5 on this page just to refresh it, when I'm hitting click me, all I'm doing is running this function here, which is finding the result element on my page, so hash result, look for an element with an ID of result, and then I'm just calling the append method again, and I'm just saying, hey, just append this fragment. Now, before I was passing I was passing a plain string. Note I've got a bit of HTML in here. jQuery will detect that. It'll say, oh, this string contains HTML, and it'll actually parse that into valid DOM elements and then inject it rather than injecting it verbatim. Okay? So you'll see I've got a break element, and I'm getting a new line every single time. So it's a very adaptive language. You'll find that many of the functions are overloaded, so they do different things depending on what it is that you pass to the function. Case in point, the click function. If you don't pass anything to the click function, so if I didn't pass this handler, if I didn't pass this handler to the click function, I just called click, it just triggers the click event on everything. So blah.click, it's going to click everything, pass it something, you're going to subscribe to it. Now, doing this can create issues. If you have a large page, say you have 100 links on your page, and you want to subscribe an event handler to every single one of those, you could go ahead and subscribe an event handler to every single link on your page. But there are issues with that. One, it's an awful lot of functions that are living on the stack in your JavaScript memory. So you have scalability issues in the browser and it's going to slow down. Two, if you're using Ajax or any type of dynamic scripting that's going to change the DOM. So say the page loads, you have 100 links on the page that were sent down from the server. You find all the links, you add a click handler, but then something else that happens on the page can add more links to the page. Those new links aren't going to get your event handler added to them. Okay? You get around that using something called event delegation. And this is generally the preferred model for doing events in jQuery now. So rather than using the bind method, we use this method called live. And what live does is it says, okay, I know you want to bind to the click method, click event, of, in this case, any element that's in this collection. But rather than doing it directly to this element that I currently have, I'm going to go up the DOM tree until I find a common parent. Generally, it'll just go up till it goes to the body. And I'm going to attach the event handler there. Now, the reason we can do that is because, of course, the DOM bubbles events. So if you click on something here, that event will keep bubbling up until somebody handles it. And even if they handle it, they have to forcefully stop the bubbling via stop propagation to stop it bubbling to their parent. So you can have a single event handler at the top of your window that listens for events everywhere, and then using properties on the event object, in this case the target property, you can find out, hey, where did this event actually originate from? I'm handling it on the body tag, but I'd like to know what element initially triggered it. And this takes care of all that for you. So instead of saying bind, I just say live. Solution. Done. Over. And so any time any new anchor tag, in this case, gets added as a child to my links element, it'll automatically get this handler because it's just the same handler. It'll just bubble up when it does it. And that's how this works. So I have a list of links. This is my links list. I've attached a handler via the live method. It'll be somewhere above me in the tree. And when I click on this, you'll see what I'm doing is actually adding a link to the same list of links. But if I click on any of these new ones, it still works because I'm using live. Now, if I change this back and I change this to bind and I refresh the page, we'll see that these ones work, but as soon as I get to the fifth one, it stops working. Okay. Conversely, there is a live, there is a kill. So you can, unlike unbind, synonymous with unbind, you can also kill your live events. So I mentioned that you can deal with coordinates when you're doing mouse events. So my trackMouse.click, this is my checkbox. I'm saying when you click the checkbox, go ahead and if it's checked, then I want you to hook up a mouse move event handler to the HTML tag. I'm passing in E, which is a jQuery event, and you can see that the E object has some properties on it, page Y and page X. I've got my offset calculation to put it in the right page, right place. I'm just modifying the CSS of my little box that's going to move around the screen, top and left. It's very straightforward. Then I'm going inside that box to update the coordinates that I had in my definition list, and I'm just passing them in using the text method, which takes the element and then sets the value inside that. And I'm using this end method again to undo it each time. And if it's unchecked, I'm using unbind to destroy all that stuff. And so as I'm moving the mouse around now, nothing happens. I click that, and now it's going to track my mouse around like so. Okay. So very, very powerful. So to finish off, because I've only got about 5 minutes left, let's look at some of the more flashier stuff, animation. So jQuery contains a core animation library. It contains the foundations of how you do animation. You have a loop which runs, you have some values that you want to animate to, and then every time the loop goes over, you change something from its current value to its next value. I mean, that's the basics of animation. You can do that in a linear state, in a linear fashion, so that you increment it by one every time, or you can use what are called easing functions, so that instead of doing one every time, you use some mathematical formula to change the value that you do it by each time. That's how you get your nice, you know, slide in and slow down, so it simulates gravity, or you can have a function that goes above and below the x-axis, so you can have it go to the beyond the position you want, then back again, and then beyond again, like an elastic type thing. You can do all that type of stuff. The things that you're animating are CSS properties. That's what the animate function does. So if you look at this page here, and I zoom out a little bit, what I've got is a box, and I want to animate my box. Here it is. So when I click on the box, it does some moving. I click on it here, it does some more moving. When I click on it again, I'm making it bigger. When I click on it again, I'm making it bigger again, and then I'm shrinking it. Did you notice that? It went big, and then it went small. And then I click, and then I faded it out. So, to get to the crux of it, essentially what we have is, I have a function I've called apply effect, and in here you'll see there's an animate function. You call animate on the jQuery collection that you want to, that contains the objects that you want to animate, the elements. You pass in an object literal which describes the CSS properties that you want to animate. Now this page is a little bit more complicated because I've sort of had a storyboard. I click it, it does one thing, I click it, do another. So up here I've got a variable called effects, which is just an array, and this contains all the object literals that represent the animations that I want to happen as I click. So the first time I want to animate the CSS left property to a value of 400, then I'm going to animate it to the top property to 200, then I'm going to animate the padding property to 50, and then I've got an array. So what I'm saying here is, okay, I want you to animate height and width at the same time, from 400 to 400, both of them, and then after that animation is finished, I want you to immediately animate the height back to 200. So you can do simultaneous animation by just having an object literal that has more than one property, and you can chain the animate call by saying my collection.animate blah, and then immediately saying .animate again, something else, that will automatically chain them and build up a storyboard in memory. And then I've just got a string fade out, and that correlates with a fade out function that's also available in jQuery, which does basically just automatically animates the opacity property for you. So to show you this, the fact that this is, and I've killed it already, to show you the fact that this is actually building up something in memory as I click it, I've actually bound to the keyboard event as well, so I can push the arrow key to make this animate. And what I'm going to do is, rather than waiting for it to finish, I'm just going to hit the arrow key really, really quickly. And I'm going to let go. And you can see it continues to animate all the way through to the end. And that's because every time it happened, that animate function got called, jQuery stored inside of itself this stack of animations that it has to play, and it keeps playing them, no matter how fast they come in, until they're finished, or you purposely tell it to stop animating again. Okay, so it's a very, very powerful animation framework. It gives you all the foundations for doing really, really cool things. And people have created great plugins to augment the animation library or to add different effects to it and things like that as well. Okay. To finish off, I did mention in the beginning about plugins. If you go to the jQuery website, you'll see there's a link up the top for plugins. Now, finding plugins, in all honesty, is a bit of a crapshoot. You can come here, and this is basically an open library where anyone can come in and upload a plugin and describe it. I have two plugins up on here. Most people tend to, the popular plugins have their source code stored on GitHub, because that's where jQuery is stored, so mine are up on GitHub as well. But a lot of people have great plugins that are just on their blog. And so it can be difficult to find really, really good jQuery plugins. If you're going to use jQuery and you want to find this stuff, Stack Overflow is a great place to ask, with a lot of jQuery people talking on Stack Overflow. If you use Twitter, I have a search column that was a hashtag of jQuery or a search thing of jQuery, and I just look at that a few times a day to get, you know, ideas of any new plugins that people are creating that I might want to look at. But unfortunately, at the moment, your best place to find good plugins is anywhere else you would in open source. You know, search, try and look for reviews that people have done, look at community ratings on this site, but the community ratings system isn't really used a lot on here. And I do encourage you that when you're doing jQuery development, try and think about everything you do in such a way that you can wrap it in a reusable plugin. Try not to just write code in your page that can just be run in that page. Try and think about how you can modularize it, just like you would any other object-oriented code base, into the jQuery plugins framework so that you can easily either reuse it across your own projects or upload it to your blog or to this site so that other people can get the love out of it as well. So with that, I think I've run out of time. So if you've got any questions, I'll be hanging around a little bit now. Have we got time for questions here?
Yeah, you can take a few
questions. Take a few questions, sure.
I know that jQuery 1.4.2 library never had the IntelliSense updated. What about 1.4.3? When's that coming?
So we have a bit of a sticky issue. But what we are doing is, you know, the ASP.NET Coplex site?
Yeah.
We're going to release a tool on there that runs in the browser that you can use that will generate a VS Doc file for you. So I wrote a tool in my first few months here that does that. The way it works is it actually goes up to this website, jQuery.com. If you go to the api.jquery.com/API, the question was, there was no VS Doc IntelliSense file for jQuery 1.4.2, and is there going to be one for 1.4.3? This is an XML feed of all the documentation on the jQuery website. This is the official documentation. I have a tool that takes this feed, munges it all together, merges it with the real jQuery object in memory, and then spits out a VS Doc file for you based on the real documentation. So I'm going to upload that tool to code the Coplex site in the next few weeks, and then you know, feel free to use it and generate your own VS Doc file. No, well, unfortunately, currently the tool only works with the format of this XML feed, but if you document them using that format, you could easily modify my tool just to point at your feed file and it would work with a little bit of work. So, any other questions? Nope. Okay, great. Thanks, everybody.